is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladheena yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabeelillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. China's president says the era of his country being bullied is gone forever as he hails what he calls the irreversible rise of China. Nearly 200 more unmarked graves are discovered near a former church-run indigenous residential school in Canada. And also in our headlines, Brazilians take to the streets in support of a bid by opposition lawmakers to impeach President Bolsonaro on corruption allegations. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. China's President Xi Jinping says the era of Beijing being bullied is gone forever. He was speaking at an event marking the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party.
The Chinese people will never allow any foreign forces to bully, oppress, or enslave us. Whoever wants to do so will surely face bloodshed in front of a great wall of steel built by more than 1.4 billion Chinese people.
Xi said the Communist Party has restored national pride. The Chinese president hailed what he called the irreversible rise of China. He underlined that his country has achieved its first centenary goal of building a moderately well-off society and eliminating absolute poverty. He added that China is now striving toward its second goal of turning into a modern and powerful socialist country in all respects. When pledging to build up China's military, the president said he remains committed to the reunification of Taiwan and stress the autonomy held by Hong Kong and Macau. Well, in Canada, another 182 unmarked graves have been discovered at a third indigenous residential school, the latest in a series of findings that have caused outrage across the country. The remains of pupils aged 7 to 15 were found near a former church-run school in Cranbrook, British Columbia. The grim development follows two other reports of similar massive findings at such schools. Almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found in the previous findings. The Roman Catholic Church, which ran most of these residential schools, has not yet issued a formal apology. Angry people in Canada have destroyed or set on fire a number of churches. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the discoveries were, quote, a shameful reminder of the systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that Indigenous people have faced. Human rights activist Firas Al-Najm says racism is deeply rooted in the history of Canada, whose foundation was based on colonization.
Most people know very well that in Canada there is a systematic racism in the system. How they built and established the system was based on colonization, and obviously that requires a lot of murders and ethnic cleansing and things like this. There was a lot of massacres that were done. That's what we read a lot in history when you dig deep inside. And I think now it's getting more evident. I mean, now these new reports, these new tests, these new investigations that people are doing, I guess there's some technology that's being used now to reveal all this. And I think it's about time that that there's accountability and there's justice for the indigenous people. Well, the Canadian government, they issue a lot of statements, they make a lot of promises, but there's no real implementation, right? Because it really will reveal their history. It will reveal certain political officials that people hold highly pretty much till now, maybe possibly. And if this leaks out and this information comes out, it's going to show the true face of what kind of government we have here in Canada.
We're going to go back to our top story for this half hour, where China's President Xi Jinping says the era of Beijing being bullied is gone forever. He made the comments at an event marking the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party in China. Author and columnist Dana Tangyan joins us now from Beijing. Mr. Tangyan, welcome to the program. Walk us through the recent comments made by China's President Xi Jinping.
Well, the most important thing is to put it in into context. 100 years ago, China was basically an occupied land. Colonial powers, the French, the United States, Britain, etc., Germany, had occupied and taken concessions because they demanded that they had the right to sell drugs to China, opium. And today, China is no longer under any kind of domination, although it continues to be under threat from those same colonial powers, more so the U.S. than anybody else. I think Xi made a statement to the party. This was a unique event in that it was a 100th anniversary, but it was not a national holiday, nor did he choose to have a great big military parade or do anything. The people that were in Tiananmen Square were invited guests, mostly diplomats, and also party members. The message was directly to the party, although the people were listening. It talked about what China has done over the last 100 years under Communist Party, and what it intends to do, and that the journey is by far not over. So it was a very stirring statement for those who attended and those who watched. Generated a tremendous amount of pride without going over the top in terms of pomp and circumstances.
Also, and as you mentioned in the political context, this is also maybe, I won't say a warning, but it is a indication also to the United States as well, given the recent tensions between Washington and Beijing over a number of issues, the South China Sea, the issue of Taiwan, the trade war that has been going on for a few years now?
Yes, Beijing is well aware that Washington sees its hegemony as key to world peace. Unfortunately, that does not fit within China's idea of a peaceful rise. Right now, when you start looking at the different systems, the U.S. for the last 40 years has been going sideways. The middle class has decreased. Buying power has basically been minimally increased, and the number of poor have gone up. Meanwhile, a small number of rich continue to get richer. There are huge social and ethnic problems within the United States. We saw that on January 6th with the storming of the Capitol. These are internal problems, but America has chosen to say that it's somehow China's fault. China, over that same 40-year period, has gone from literally $150 per capita GDP to over 10,000. They see this as a mark of real human rights, the ability to live in a safe environment, have access to schools, healthcare, city services, opportunity. So there's a very real friction between the way that these countries see themselves ideologically, how they measure progress, human rights, and that will continue. China was just firmly saying what they have said many times before, this is not new, that China will not be a colonial vassal at this time, nor is the plan to be any time in the future.
All right, thanks a lot, Inner Tangen, author and columnist joining us from Beijing. Brazilians have staged fresh rallies to call for the impeachment of President Jair Bolsonaro as more corruption allegations have surfaced in relation to acquiring coronavirus vaccines. Protesters gathered in front of National Congress in the capital of Brasilia, chanting slogans against Bolsonaro. The demonstrations came after opposition lawmakers submitted an impeachment request to the Chamber of Deputies on Wednesday following the resignation of a senior health ministry official over vaccine fraud allegations. The Senate probe has already revealed corruption of government officials who sought to fast-track and overpay for COVID vaccines. President Bolsonaro has been heavily criticized for downplaying the virus and mishandling of the pandemic. COVID-19 has so far killed more than 500,000 people in Brazil. The U.S. Homeland Security report has warned about the possibility of domestic extremist attacks ahead of the summer season. The report says violent extremists might seek to take advantage of easing COVID-19 restrictions and more access to public gatherings to conduct attacks. It added that critical infrastructure and police officers might also be targeted. The report also expressed concern over the rise in mass shootings in America. It said the upcoming 4th of July celebrations and other anniversaries are typically associated with high-profile racially or ethnically driven attacks. Former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kiriakou says the allegations of election fraud in the 2020 U.S. presidential race might encourage some people to take up arms.
I think that Donald Trump's insistence that he won the election and that the election was stolen from him and that he is somehow magically going to become president again in August is forcing a lot of people to consider taking up arms in their view to protect their liberty, to protect the Constitution, to fight for Donald Trump. And, you know, where we've always had these white supremacist groups or illegal militias, I think this adds another layer. And it's something that the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and even state bureaus of investigation are very worried about. We have evidence that white supremacists have infiltrated local police departments. They've infiltrated the military. We saw that really turn violent on January the 6th. So this is something that the FBI ought to be worried about.
Donald Rumsfeld, former Pentagon chief, dubbed the architect of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, has died at the age of 88. Rumsfeld worked in the Republican administrations of Presidents Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and George W. Bush. He oversaw the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks in 2001. 2 years later, the U.S. military invaded Iraq under his command. He came under fire after images surfaced of American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners in the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. He resigned as the Secretary of Defense in 2006. Political commentator Max Perry says former Pentagon Chief Donald Rumsfeld has the blood of many people on his hands.
Well, I think like a lot of people, there's one less war criminal alive today with the news of Rumsfeld's death. And it really cannot be overstated that this is someone who shouldn't have been allowed to live as a free man in his final years. And it's just unfortunate that he, like the other key officials in the Bush administration, you know, Wolfowitz, Cheney, Powell, and of course Bush himself, all escaped justice and have never been brought up on charges of crimes against humanity, as we all know they should, despite the widespread evidence that Rumsfeld and the other neocons in the administration lied to go to war in Iraq in total violation of the UN Charter as an illegal war of aggression. So I did a quick survey of the Western media coverage, and even a few places like the Associated Press were trying to whitewash his legacy, and you know, they eulogized him as, quote, a cunning leader who was undermined by the Iraq war, as if it was something that happened to him as opposed to war crimes committed against the Iraqi people, where as many as a million people died.
Elsewhere, parliamentary inquiry has found that British police breached fundamental rights in handling the events held after the killing of Sarah Everard by an officer. The report says the police failed to understand their legal duties during a vigil for Everard, who was kidnapped and killed by an officer. The report adds the forces in Bristol used excessive force against the Kill the Bill demonstrators, who were denouncing a controversial bill that was introduced then. The bill was introduced after police's crackdown on the people at Everard's vigil and allowed law enforcement to impose conditions on protests. The findings have resulted in proposed amendments to the bill due to be debated in Parliament on Monday. Political Bureau Chief of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is in Beirut for talks with high-ranking figures, including Hezbollah Secretary General, on political and regional developments. Mariam Saleh reports on that.
Head of Hamas Political Bureau Ismail Haniyeh continues his visit to Lebanon, where he held a general meeting for Palestinian and Lebanese political representatives. The Hamas leader gave an extensive overview of the significance of Al-Quds Sword, a battle which he believed changed the strategic layout of the entire region.
They aim to remove the Palestinian issue from the entire region and press ahead with the normalization of ties with Israel. But they saw many surprises, and one of the main surprises was the resistance of our people in the lands of 1948. Despite the apartheid and years of bitter occupation, the surprise was that the new generation rose in all areas and confronted the occupation forces directly. Also, Al-Quds Sword has enabled the resistance to enforce new rules of engagement.
Earlier, Haniyeh met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, where the two leaders discussed the latest confrontation in Palestine. Building on the experiences of the past conflicts and the possible strategic coordinated actions in the future were some of the issues in the talks between the two sides. Hezbollah Secretary General had reiterated in the speeches following the Battle of Al-Quds Sword, Hezbollah's resistance take part in a regional retaliation in case the Israeli forces continued their aggressive practices in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Experts described the meeting between the two resistance leaders as pivotal, especially after the last battle in Palestine. Hamas leader's visit comes as the Israeli regime continues its policy of mass destruction of Palestinian houses in the Salwan neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds to make way for settlements in the occupied territory. The resistance has warned Israeli forces they are crossing red lines. Hamas political bureau chief hailed coordination with the resistance in Lebanon, saying Hamas will not give up on the rights of the Palestinians, especially the right of return, and especially now that there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by his power and brought the sight-giving day through his mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon thee. By Muhammad, the chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Without the whole world paying close attention to such crimes, the very idea of our humanity is at risk, says Hamid Dabashi, author, in an article published under the heading Tulsa Massacre: Why We Need to Remember the Darkest Chapters of U.S. History. Stay tuned for more. Why would we not know about the Tulsa Massacre? What has gone wrong in the American educational system that we would have been denied such an iconic piece of historical literacy, which would have significantly altered the reading of the rest of the country's history? The Tulsa Race Massacre took place between May 31st and June 1st, 1921, when armed mobs of white people attacked black residents and destroyed homes and businesses in the Greenwood district of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The massacre is not exactly a secret of the U.S. history. Scholars such as late Howard Zinn were particular in detailing the hidden horrors of American history, including the Tulsa Massacre. In his widely popular A People's History of the United States in 1980, Zinn gave an entirely iconoclastic version of U.S. history, concentrating on the factual but forgotten violence at the root of the American Republic.
many other scholars have closely examined the massacre. Tim Madigan's seminal book, The Burning, in 2001, is a solid piece of scholarship and a compelling narrative detailing the massacre. The kind of historiography that Zinn and scores of other American historians represent is akin to what emerged in India as subaltern studies paying detailed attention to the unwritten or else forgotten events in history and requiring a series of reconsideration of both the archival and the analytical tools for deciphering the past. There is a serious gap between the body of scholarship produced on the detailed American history, particularly the stories of Native Americans and African Americans, and what make it to popular venues such as Hollywood or the U.S. educational system. That educational system is itself under systematic attack by white supremacists who dismiss all critical thinking as woke culture or cancel culture, as they did with the term multiculturalism just a few years earlier, and thus demonize and dismiss the underlying critical thinking. Right now, even the idea of critical race theory, the systematic study of racism in the U.S., has become a subject of ignorant attack by reactionary propagandists and politicians determined to sustain a white supremacist mythology of the American past. American history is not just American history. No national history ever is. It is part and parcel of world history. Because of the enormous power of the U.S. in the world politics, not by virtue of any moral authority, but by virtue of its sheer destructive power that is always globally on display, this history requires a critical assessment far beyond American borders. Events such as the Tulsa Race Massacre are integral to the racist underpinnings of American political culture, which manifests itself domestically in equally horrid events such as the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890, or else globally in infamous incidents such as the 1968 My Lai Massacre in Vietnam or the 2003 Fallujah Massacre in Iraq. Crimes such as these, or war crimes such as the Zionist regime's slaughter of Palestinians or the Saudi Emirati genocidal attacks in Yemen, are not only important to African Americans, Iraqis, Palestinians, or Yemenis. As the Zionist regime is being held accountable at the International Criminal Court, ICC, so must be the U.S. and any other country responsible for crimes against humanity. The terrors that the successive U.S. and Canadian governments have perpetrated against indigenous peoples through systems such as residential schools are the same magnitude. These are crimes against the whole humanity. Without the whole world paying close attention to them, the very idea of our humanity is at risk of wanton cruelties of an identical nature, but from a different angle. For any criminal atrocity that happens anywhere in the world, the perpetrators must be made fully aware that the whole world is watching them. Very reason, in 1964, Malcolm X proposed taking the case of the injustices systematically perpetrated against African Americans to the UN. According to the New York Times, the black nationalist leader started his campaign on July 17th in Cairo, where the 33 heads of independent African states held their second meeting since the Organization of African Unity was founded in Addis Ababa 14 months ago. Ideas such as Russell Tribunal, named after the prominent British philosopher Bertrand Russell, or the institutions such as the ICC alongside historical precedents such as the Nuremberg Trials all point to ways that such crimes against humanity have been brought to global attention, if not to justice. Everyone from reactionary racists to liberal Hollywood personalities may oppose or advocate for a more critical assessment of American history. But countries such as the U.S., regimes like the fake regime of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE have not just committed crimes against one people or another, they have inflicted wounds on the very idea of our humanity, and they must be held accountable. The world must know about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 in the United States, just as it must know about the genocide the Belgians committed in Congo under Leopold II, or what the French did in Africa, the Italians in Libya, or the British in India. There is a structural link between the domestic and foreign acts of mass violence perpetrated by countries such as the U.S. or its European allies. The crimes against humanity underlying such atrocities defy all ideological formations and political positions. Something far more precious is being lost at the very heart of the suffering, our shared humanity.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about Bangladesh's relations with the Israeli regime, and we shall take a look at the efforts by the United States to establish greater military presence in Pakistan following the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Recently, the Bangladeshi government made some seemingly bureaucratic modifications about Israel. It created such an outrage, or at least bafflement, that prompted the country's foreign ministry to reiterate that there is no change in travel policy towards Tel Aviv. However, given the recent developments inside the occupied territories, it might have been a test run to pilot the idea of formal diplomatic ties and see the feedback because the wobbly new Israeli administration is in desperate need of a win.
A recent move by the Bangladeshi government to remove a clause from its electronic passports that barred its nationals from traveling to the Israeli-occupied territories has created uproar about the prospects of normalizing ties with the regime. Although Dhaka says nothing has changed in its stance or foreign policy about the Israeli regime, the controversial decision shocked the Muslim nation, especially because lately Israel is under global condemnation for its recent war against the Palestinian people. Speculations over opening diplomatic ties with Israel have not been uncommon following a U.S.-sponsored deal for Arab-Israeli normalization. Since the agreement, Washington and its allies have stepped up their efforts to force more and more countries to establish relations with the Israeli regime. The UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan have already established diplomatic and economic relations, while reports suggest that some other Persian Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, and even Pakistan may be also weighing their options regarding formal ties.
Removing the Accept Israel clause from the e-passports came as a shocking betrayal to the nation, but was greatly welcomed by the Israeli regime, which used the opportunity to call for formal relations with the Muslim country. Bangladesh says its position has not changed, and Dhaka would never recognize Israel until Palestine is established as an independent and sovereign country free of any occupation forces. So why did they move to facilitate relations? Why did they do it without telling people? And was the government hiding its ties from the nation?
Since Bangladesh's independence from Pakistan in 1971, the Muslim country has only recognized Palestine as a state, and the older Bangladeshi passports used to bear the sentence, "This passport is valid for all the countries of the world except Israel." In January last year, Bangladesh was among the first in South Asia and the 119th in the world to introduce the e-passport, a travel document with a small integrated circuit or chip embedded in the cover or pages. 6 months ago, when the South Asian country rolled out its new e-passport, the phrase was removed without any public announcement, and the information came to light only when Israeli officials started hailing Dhaka's move to lift the travel ban on Israel. Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan Kamal soon after acknowledged the change, saying that his government removed the words to ensure that the passports meet international standards. Foreign Minister A.K. Abdul Momen said, "The passport is just an identity and it doesn't reflect the foreign policy of a country." He said although Tel Aviv approached Dhaka for recognition and building bilateral ties on several occasions, Bangladesh's policy is still that of the father of the nation, Bangabandhu Sheikh Mujib. Bangladesh never recognizes Israel as long as Palestine is not established as a sovereign state free on any occupation army.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Sabir Abu Maryam, Secretary General of Palestine Foundation of Pakistan. Welcome to the program, sir. And recently, Bangladesh has dropped the Accept Israel phrase from its passports, but the country's foreign ministry says there is no change in policy towards Tel Aviv. What's your take on this?
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you regarding the issue of Bangladesh and Israel normalization. First of all, I would like to say that Bangladesh is a South Asian country. A majority have Muslim people, Muslim majority country, fourth Muslim majority country in the Islamic and Muslim world. In 1971, the Bangladesh has openly affirmed its position on pro-Palestinian cause. But still, their government, all of the successor governments of Mujibur Rahman, they are following the same rules, same policy, which they adopted in 1971. founding leader of Bangladesh, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, had taken a strong pro-Palestine stance, which was followed by all the successors till now, Sheikh Hasina-led government. But such a sudden decision that came at time when Bangladesh is marking its golden jubilee, the 50 years of their country celebrations. This is a bad news. This is a very bad news for pro-Palestinian sector inside the Bangladesh. They especially they announced that the country passport will no longer bear the tax except Israel for the new passport printing. It is very bad news for the pro-Palestinian factors inside the Bangladesh, because you know that our Bangladeshi people, especially Muslims, they have their faith, they have their religious, they have their humanitarian, and all of the aspects. They have relations with the oppressed people of Palestine, and especially they have some sentiments, religious sentiments regarding the Holy Al-Aqsa and Quds al-Sharif.
Now, what happens if Bangladesh starts formal diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime, and what would be the reaction of about 150 million Bangladeshi Muslims?
Yes. As I told you earlier in the question, that the Bangladesh is the fourth Muslim populated country. You are also saying that 150 million Muslims. Yes, I think that the Muslims of Bangladesh will not accept these kinds of developments and the decisions. And it will not be accepted by the Bangladeshi Muslims. They will resist against the government, and I think they must resist to against these kinds of decisions. As I have many friends in Bangladesh, and last night and today, I also spoke with them and discussed with them the same issue. And I try to get their consent regarding the same subject. And I found that people of Bangladesh will never remain keep silent if the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina-led government, would be normalized with Israel. I think if Bangladesh will normalize with Israel, so maybe political instability begin inside the country. As we know that the people of Bangladesh have their religious faith, have the humanitarian faith, and many other aspects and relations with the land of messenger Palestine, especially with the oppressed people of Palestine. And what is happening in Palestine, they are witnessing, they are observing everything. And we saw that in last 11 days war, recently war of 11 days between Palestinian resistance and Zionist regime. And the Bangladeshi people, the Muslims, they have supported Palestinian cause. They chanted the slogan in the streets. So I believe that Bangladesh, Muslims of Bangladesh, people of Bangladesh, will never accept these kinds of decision, and they will must resist.
Could you tell us how can the West pressure Bangladesh into opening relations with Israel?
Yes, this is an interesting question. We know very well that the Western regimes, Western countries, and Western governments, especially the U.S. and European governments, they always giving the opportunity to the monarchs, to the rulers of the Muslim and third world countries. They give them opportunities for how? They maybe United States and Western countries and Western government maybe give any opportunity to Bangladesh to trade with some European countries, some other, and maybe they can enhance this kind of trade which is already exists, and maybe United States guarantee to Sheikh Hasina that she will be more prime minister for next tenure. So these kinds of things, I think they will they will pursue it. They will pursue it with Bangladesh by offering economic packages and other such things as than just the Bangladesh politics and intelligence agencies are already at the mercy of India. They are linked with Indian government, and India is a major enemy for Pakistan. So to can Western country through India put the pressure on Bangladesh, because Bangladesh has a good relations with India, and India is in the ties of United States and Israel at the same time. So I, in my opinion, the West maybe use Indian government as a tool to pressurize and to make the possible for Bangladesh to normalize with the Zionist regime of Israel. The role of the Western world and India is also seen as an integral part of the process of changing words from Bangladeshi passport.
Now, do you think Bangladesh is going to normalize relations with Israel?
Yes, I think they are ready to normalize with Israel, but the people's stance is different. The government, the changing of the words from the passport of Bangladesh, it is the big and strongest proof that the government of Bangladesh is going slowly with normalization to Israel. But their hurdle is that the ideological boundaries would not allow them to do it. If they will do it, they will see the public awakening.
Thank you, Dr. Abu Mayyam, for your precious time. Now let's see how the people on social media see the situation.
Kiryu Ibn Kazuma has reiterated the official stance by the Bangladeshi government, but believes it can be the very first step toward Israeli normalization. Dr. Sanar Khan says dropping the phrase practically means lifting travel bans to the occupied territories, which means ignoring the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Ali Masum has underlined the timing of the decision by Dhaka, noting that it is a step towards accepting the Israeli regime. This account has called the Bangladeshi government traitors because of their betrayal to the Palestinian people and cause.
Listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The United States is set to remove its military forces from Afghanistan, and the deadline is September 11th. So Washington is trying hard to find a safe foothold in the region and what seems more feasible than the nearby friend Pakistan. However, the Pakistani government has said it wouldn't allow the US to establish military bases across the border in Pakistan after the troops withdraw.
According to an agreement signed between the United States and Taliban in Qatar's Doha, Washington should withdraw all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan, but to provide security for the U.S. interests and gather intelligence in Afghanistan, the U.S. needs to remain its forces close by. Pakistan seems a very plausible option, but there are many obstacles in the road. The Pakistani government is against any such ideas, and on the other hand, the hypothetical military bases would be so close to Afghanistan that Taliban would not accept it as leaving the country. Although many believe that Islamabad is unlikely to sign off on any U.S. strikes against the Taliban that are launched from a base in Pakistan, some believe Pakistan wants to allow U.S. access to a base if it can control how it is used.
The public opinion in Pakistan has been strongly against any renewed presence by the United States, and the government says it won't allow it. But there are many reported similar cases that the U.S. used bases in Pakistan and the government denied it. There is a sad joke that says the most common species of bird in Pakistan's sky is an American drone. And let's not forget that the U.S.-Taliban agreement happened because of Pakistan, without whose active support, Taliban leaders may have never even reached the negotiating table. Therefore, the initial rejection of U.S. bases may be part of Pakistan's bargaining strategy for more gains.
Pakistan has a history of covertly giving military bases to the U.S. Giving the U.S. a military base in the southwestern Balochistan province will have far-reaching political, diplomatic, and security implications for Pakistan and the entire region. In the 1960s, Pakistan denied giving the Peshawar Bedarbar Air Base to the U.S. until Russia shot down a surveillance plane that took off from it. The government also denied access to the Shamsi Air Base until a U.S.-led clash killed 24 Pakistani soldiers in 2011, when Pakistan expelled U.S. forces. Agreeing can cause severe backlash from the people, who are highly antagonistic towards the American war in Afghanistan, but refusing may mean getting further from U.S. and further isolation. Such a move by Islamabad can lead to more pressure through multilateral institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the Financial Action Task Force. Moreover, the U.S. may be able to use it to shift the blame of its failures in Afghanistan on Pakistan, which was among the most significant factors behind the U.S.-Taliban Accord.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Sabina Siddiqui, foreign affairs journalist. Now, Mr. Siddiqui, the Pakistani government has said it wouldn't allow the U.S. to establish military bases across the border in Pakistan after the troops withdraw. Do you think Islamabad can resist such a demand if Washington insists on it?
It's like become a national security issue now, and the Taliban have threatened that any country that gives bases to the U.S. is going to be attacked by them and will be considered an enemy country as well. So consequently, Pakistan has categorically refused to give bases, and there's no more room left for that. No compromise is possible, as it is a national security matter for Pakistan itself. Now, however, Pakistan is actively engaged in the Afghan peace process, and negotiations are continuing, and Islamabad is trying its best to establish a successful peace process.
What happens if Imran Khan changes the decision and allows Washington to use Pakistan as a backup base when the American forces leave Afghanistan?
Well, the official statement has already been released. There's really no room left to change for the PM to change his mind, as the Taliban are openly threatening us, and not only us, I guess they are. It's an open threat for anybody, any country, any neighboring country which gives them a base. So there are very few choices left. Plus, you see, Pakistan is also trying to mediate in a way between the Afghan government and the Taliban. And the process is continuing right now. Let's hope for the best. Maybe we have a positive outcome from that.
Now, will Taliban agree to continuous deals with the U.S. in case Washington manages to set up military bases in Pakistan?
Well, now, it depends more on how Washington deals with the matter, and I think they are doing their best. And I don't think civil war in the country suits the Taliban's interests or the Afghan government or even the U.S. So let's hope that better sense prevails, and no such thing happens. Otherwise, that would be total chaos in the region.
Taliban has recently announced that Turkish forces must withdraw their troops as part of the deal with the U.S. for pullout of foreign forces. What does this say about the future of the country?
Well, it's I have been reading tweets a lot on Twitter from both sides. The Turkish side seems quite hopeful, quite optimistic that they will be able to hold on after the U.S. forces leave, as they are saying that they've never been attacked by the Afghans before. And there are Afghan accounts on Twitter threatening the Turks directly. But one doesn't know if they are genuine IDs or whatever. So it's a very fluid situation. It's very unpredictable. Maybe they can pull it off. Let's hope the Afghan peace process is completed satisfactorily before the U.S. forces leave. And the situation should be calm, and there would be no such problem, I think. Then the mood will be better. And the Turkey seems to want a role. Maybe Istanbul is communicating with the Afghans behind the scenes. I don't think that can be ruled out either.
Now, will Islamabad eventually let the United States set up bases in Pakistani territory after their pullout from Afghanistan? And what does it mean for the U.S.-Pakistan relations?
Well, we have already refused. And as for the U.S.-Pak relations, our bilateral relations are there since decades. And it's not just about Afghanistan. We have viable ties in many other sectors and areas, such as trade. And then there is, Pakistan has a certain geostrategic value. And I don't think Washington would ignore, but the ties will continue satisfactorily. There may be, it's already happened, we have refused. So that is done. And the ties are still intact. So I guess we have survived.
Thank you, Mrs. Siddiqui, for being on the program. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Asaf Bai has reflected the sentiments of the Pakistani people about the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Ahmed has criticized the use of assassinations drones from the Pakistani territory, asking the government to cooperate with other countries towards peace and not more wars. Abdullah Khan is of the opinion that allowing U.S. bases may have constructive consequences for Pakistan if the country can have some sort of control over its activities. Ali Awan is a firm believer that Islamabad will not eventually bow to U.S. pressure and host military bases in its territories.
And that was our episode on the speculations over the future of relations between Bangladesh and Israel, as well as the U.S. efforts to get Islamabad's go-ahead for military bases in Pakistan following the pullout from Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight. Hopes have been raised of summer holidays in Europe for fully vaccinated Britons as a deal with Brussels on COVID passports neared completion and Germany failed to convince popular destinations to put an emergency brake on UK visitors. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Daniel Boffey and Sam Jones. The piece is titled UK and Brussels Near Deal on COVID Passports to Boost Holiday Hopes. hopes have been raised of summer holidays in Europe for fully vaccinated Britons as a deal with Brussels on COVID passports neared completion, and Germany failed to convince popular destinations to pull an emergency brake on UK visitors. Restrictions on travel are tightening across the European continent for tourists coming from the United Kingdom who have not had two jabs, owing to concerns over the highly transmissible Delta variant of the coronavirus, now dominant in Britain. Portugal announced on Monday, 28th of June, that people unable to prove full vaccination status would face 14 days in quarantine. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said Britons traveling to the Balearic Islands would need to show either a negative PCR test or proof that they have been fully vaccinated to avoid having to self-isolate. From Wednesday, 30th of June, the Balearics will be on the UK government's green list of countries from which travellers will not need to quarantine when they return home. But for travellers from the United Kingdom who have had both doses of an approved vaccine, the prospect of a relatively normal summer break appears brighter, with popular destinations loath to shut the doors on those who are unlikely to be infectious. According to the latest data, 61.9% of UK adults are now fully vaccinated, and 84.4% have had at least a first dose of the vaccine.